I sort of have a database of like hundreds and hundreds of deals that like are going sideways currently. I get a ton of information through LinkedIn, through like an anonymous inbox that I have through Twitter, which I'm very active on as well. And so my intention, in terms of like getting on those is to help people not make mistakes.
Welcome to Investing in the US, a podcast for real estate investors, business owners, and aspiring entrepreneurs looking to grow their wealth by investing in US real estate. I'm your host, Reid Goossens, and so far, I've acquired over $800 million worth of investments on various properties across the United States. On this podcast, I interview go-getters, risk takers, and the best in the business to learn more about their investment journey and the cutting-edge strategies they are applying towards building a legacy. For more on growing your own wealth and by investing in the US, visit www.reidgoossens.com. Today on the show, I have the pleasure of speaking with Alexei Chernobolsky. Now, Alexei advises LPs on existing and future investments, and he writes to over 3,000 LP investors on his weekly blog called lplessons.substack.com. And he tries to explain how to properly vet and think about LP investments in the grand scheme of their entire portfolios. Now, Alexei also helps general partners on matters relating to LPs, such as capital calls and feedbacks on investment decks. Now, prior to advising LPs, Alexei ran Store Capital's $10 billion commercial real estate portfolio and oversaw the firm's underwriting team, and he has a great extensive knowledge about vetting deals. So on today's show, we're talking in depth about what it means to be not only an LP in today's environment with a lot of capital calls going on, but also what it means to understand risk when you're investing in syndications. Can you rewind the clock and tell me how you made your first ever dollar as a kid as we get into this interview?
Well, I guess in terms of if you go way back, I came to the US at 11. And as part of that, you know, both of my parents had a little bit of a hard time, somewhere between a little and a lot of a hard time kind of getting started here because their degrees weren't really recognized. So my brother and I started trying to help. I think my first dollars were probably in table tennis. I played pretty seriously. And I coached pretty seriously as well. You know, so at some point I ran like pretty big clinics with, in some cases, like dozens of people. Did a lot of like one-on-one coaching. So it was actually not real estate related, but it was fun.
That's a super interesting. I've never had anyone on the show out of you know nearly 10 years of doing this podcast that has done table tennis. You were you professional?
I won, I think it was 5 like Arizona championships when I was a kid, junior championships, and was sort of on my way to train for the Olympics. And then you kind of, you know, have to decide whether table tennis is going to be your profession. And the reality is, it's like it doesn't pay as much as tennis, let's just say. and you know, and so like I ended up going to college, so that sort of took me on a different path.
Yeah, right. That's super interesting. I think everyone thinks they're really good at table tennis until they probably come up against someone like yourself and you just get absolutely owned. So some of those YouTube videos that you see people like standing way back from the table and they're smacking it. It looks like they're putting as much effort as hitting a tennis ball on a tennis court, yeah. But it's on this tiny little table and they're still making the ball hit the table. So awesome stuff, mate. But talk to me about your background. I mentioned earlier that you ran a $10 billion, helped run a $10 billion real estate, commercial real estate firm in the underwriting space. How did you get into that initially? And was real estate always in the blood coming out of university?
Yeah, coming out of university, I spent you know, a decent amount of time in like actually algorithm trading, value investing, distressed debt to some extent. Real estate was something that was interesting to me, but not necessarily something that I sort of directly participated in until I got to Store, which is the experience that you mentioned. And there I was really fortunate. I joined at the right time. The company was growing. Before me, and I certainly don't deserve any credit. They got an investment from Berkshire Hathaway for a decent chunk of the public stock. And, you know, we're just like on this amazing path of growth, still kind of early, but pretty big at the same time. And I think when I got there, I think we were at about 4 billion or so in terms of assets. And by the time I left, we were well over 10. Wow. I think it was pretty close to 11. And that's net In other words, we also bought a lot more that we ended up selling during that process. And yeah, I mean, it was just a fascinating experience. I mean, you're talking, by the time I left, it was 2,900 properties that sort of all were in different industries all across the US. I also sort of like handled the firm's response during COVID, which was, good in terms of lessons, but bad in terms of getting gray hairs. It was just, it was an amazing, amazing experience.
Yeah, how long were you there for?
I think 4.5 years, there was a.
Yeah, and now, what have you pivoted to? I mentioned the blog earlier. You now spend a lot of time educating LP investors about the risks and pitfalls of potentially investing in syndications, right?
Yeah, I think the best way to describe it is I saw a pretty big gap in this space. I think if you look at the fundraised dollars in terms of syndications, they have somewhat consistently gone up in the past few years, and they're at levels that are pretty unprecedented relative to, let's say, like 10 years ago or even 5 years ago. On the one hand, there's a ton of people that are placing money into the space. On the other hand, many of those people don't come from investments backgrounds. They usually made their money in a million different ways outside of real estate, essentially, or investing. And I wanted to help them make sure that they're sort of understand what they're getting into on the front end, right? If they're thinking about a transaction, and then if they're already in a transaction, and let's say they got a capital call, or some sort of they have several options, for example, to exercise. So they can also sort of get independent feedback from a party that's not biased, right? Meaning if you sort of go to the GP and ask for feedback, in some cases they'll give you good feedback. In many cases, it's kind of biased in a sense. And this is just, as far as I know, an independent place to get advice. I think, as far as I know, still the only independent place, which is kind of surprising given like the size of the market.
There's a couple online groups I know out there. 506C Investing, was it 506B Investing? I can't remember the name. There's another group out of Florida that sort of rank more operators more than anything. I don't know if they actually go to that level of detail. I'm not invited because I'm an operator, but they compare notes in terms of how people communicate and all that sort of stuff. Are you a part of those forums?
I think I tried to get into one. I can't remember which one, and they didn't let me in. I think it makes sense because I guess they might think that I'm there to sell my services. I would argue the opposite, but that's fine. I sort of have a database of like hundreds and hundreds of deals that like are going sideways currently. I get a ton of information through LinkedIn, through like an anonymous inbox that I have, through Twitter, which I'm very active on as well. And so my intention, in terms of like getting on those, is to help people not make mistakes. Many times there are challenging situations where like an existing investor doesn't know what to do with a capital call. And I think, to your point, I think those, just to be clear, like I think those groups are great, right? Because you sort of like outsource feedback to other LPs. I think one of the challenges is some of those LPs behind the scenes might be biased in a certain way. Also, I would say some of them might not have the time to dig into something properly, right? And you might not get the best feedback. But I'm a very big fan of like what those groups are trying to do and
Yeah,
have been
no, I
doing.
think
By the way,
so.
I mean, just to be clear, they way precede me. And I think some of those have been around for like 10 years or something like that.
They have been. And going back to your thing, one of your statements you made earlier was around the amount of capital that has been raised right now, or has been in the last couple of years, and it's been nearly euphoric from the retail investor, and that's been truly driven from the Jobs Act, right? And, pre-2012, the Jobs Act wasn't around. There was you could still raise money privately, but it was usually through non-solicitation. You couldn't advertise your services online, and we're now in a new world. And you saw in the 2013s, 14s, 15s, a lot of crowdfunding platforms came online. Some of them, most of them, have probably pretty much gone away, and the strongest have survived. But I'm curious because I've got thoughts on what's happening right now in the environment. But what are you seeing as the last 10 years, we've had this run up in people really like throwing money. Like you could send out an email and it would be refunded in less than 3 hours, like crazy stuff. to now capital calls, deals going sideways, all that sort of stuff. What's your sort of thoughts and two cents on where we are right now?
If your question is specific to distress, I think there's a lot of distress. And I think I have a very hard time believing that it's going to work its way through the system in a positive way. I mean, I have to be candid when I say that. Even if rates do go down, I think they can't go down to the degree that is necessary in order to save some of the equity that's sort of, essentially worthless. And I don't think I'm talking about $1 million. I'm not talking about $100 million. I think we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars of equity. And I think really probably billions. I don't have the exact number in front of me. In terms of the good, I think there's a pretty real dislocation in the marketplace now, right? Like I think what I'm seeing behind the scenes is a pretty big conflict of interest and misalignment of incentives in a sense between like lenders, GPs, and LPs. And usually those parties are friends in a sense, right? And they sort of act together, right? But in signs of distress, a lot of that falls by the wayside. So just to give you an example, if a deal is in distress and, for example, you can sell it today and get 50 cents on the dollar, assuming there isn't a clear path, right, to making everything back, the LP is like almost desperate and like begging the GP just to sell to get something back, to not take on additional risk. The GP, on the other hand, and I'm putting ethics to the side because I'm just explaining to you what I'm observing. Mm-hmm. The GP, all else equal, has sort of an incentive to not be on the Wall Street Journal for losing capital for investors. And that might be in direct conflict to what the LPs want, right? And then in many cases, the lender is underwater, you know, in terms of like the property is worth far less than the loan amount, right? And then it's a funny thing because sometimes the lenders don't want to foreclose because they don't want sort of like, the auditors to take them to lunch, so to speak, on the rest of their portfolio. So there's like a lot of things going behind the scenes that I think are very interesting. To some degree, they're also concerning, I think. But also, you know, I don't think you're talking about the whole market. There's plenty of transactions that are very healthy today. Plenty of new deals that are getting done that are very good as well. And there a lot of those are getting done at like really attractive basis. You know, as with any market, I think there's a decent amount of good and some bad as well.
Do you think it's the 2008 for commercial real estate right now?
It's hard for me to comment because I was in college in 2008. Like I wasn't really around to see it. If you were to ask the same question, but say 2008 for real estate that was syndicated, I think I would say yes, or like pretty damn close to it. There's almost not a day that goes by that I don't get several emails about people losing, in some cases, millions of dollars. And in some cases, it's like across five different GPs, 20 different deals, you know, like, And I think I have I know I have like a very tiny sample of what's going on in the larger like U.S. syndicated space, and it's pretty challenging. I mean, like, you know, there's consequences to raising rates to where they got raised at the rate that they got raised, and I think we're seeing that.
Yep, it was bound to break, and I think, you know, we're talking about the syndication space, but let's not also forget about there's institutions out there losing pen and keys back today as well. Like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like this is not immune to the big guys aren't getting hurt as well. Like there, totally. You know, I saw Greystar had to just hand back the keys. Greystar on two assets in Dallas, two multifamily, nice looking assets in Dallas, had to hand them back.
Yep.
So it's not immune to just the syndication space, but I think the syndication space has been the ugly word. I'm a syndicator, right? I'm not going to be immune from saying that I'm not, but how much fever there was around just getting a deal done at any cost and hard money and competing, and it was a knife fight. And then for the US economy to shift the way it did as quickly as it did, I think a lot of people, even very, very smart people, didn't expect that coming. Would you agree with that?
I think that's totally true. I totally agree with everything you said. I think the slight difference, and I think it's either slight or material, depending on your sort of like opinion, I suppose. But I think even though a lot of institutional investors didn't foresee this coming, they go into investments knowing that like losing your money is a possibility, right? I think I do not see that in many retail investors. Like, in other words, even today, as all of this news is happening, I'll get calls from LPs that are like, hey, I really want to invest $1 million into this. Like, I just don't see why I shouldn't. The worst thing that can happen is I just get my money back. And I'm like, duh, that's not how it works. You know, and so I think that is a pretty material difference between the two. In other words, I think anyone with the right mind like couldn't have predicted exactly what was going on. But at the same time, the just knowing that an investment can lose money and that the worst case is not getting your money back is something that institutional investors, I mean, they just live and breathe this stuff, and it's like so obvious. And All of them going into what was going on, they were like, well, okay, like we're screwed. Like rates went up. If they continue to go up, like we might as well write this off. Right. And in many ways, a lot of the funds that you're speaking about, which by the way, is definitely not just Greystar. I mean, there's like an article every week about handing the keys back. And, you know, like the one of the other benefits that some of those folks have is that they're deploying out of funds. And so they can actually take a loss or two that is pretty significant, but still return a decent amount across the entire fund. Whereas a lot of the syndicated deals are deal by deal. And, you know, like a loss of capital is a complete loss of capital.
Hey guys, I just want to take a second to share with you our latest multifamily investment opportunity, the Broadwater at Salado Creek, located in San Antonio, Texas, the market where we've got the most experience in. Now, rapid fire, here are the reasons why we love this deal. It's got fantastic investor returns. We are projecting around 20% annualized investor returns for those people who choose to invest in this deal. The second thing is that all the 176 units are in classic condition, which means we can come in, use our renovation program, and push rents even higher. Thirdly, is that multifamily pricing for properties have fallen more today than they did during the 2008 global financial crisis. This could very well be the best time in the commercial real estate cycle to pick up cheap deals. Now, if you're interested, click in the description or reach out to me directly at reed@rsnpropertygroup.com. Now let's get back into the episode.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And having the run-up in just how many people got involved in, has been getting involved in the last, you know, 10 years has been, it's been quite mind blowing, particularly in some certain real estate assets, multifamily being one of them. I guess my question to you is, do you think there'll be changes? I know you're not an expert on the SEC and the way in which you raise money, but do you think there's going to be changes given some of the distress we're seeing right now from governing officials?
I've never got that question.
I'm putting you on the spot a bit. Like,
yeah, you know, no, it's an interesting question. I've never thought about it. I guess the way that I would put it is, if I'm right in terms of where things are headed, I would be surprised if there aren't changes. Now, the challenge with that is, what should the changes be? Which is, I mean, that's a whole hour podcast in and of itself. And I don't know if I'm ready to have it, to be honest, because I speak pretty openly about my opinions. And one of my opinions is that being accredited like really says nothing about your investing ability, right? In other words, it certainly gives you some level of wealth, and like, maybe you can say like stability, and perhaps you could even say like it gives you sort of a cushion to lose some money, right? But at the same time, the challenges of someone having a $20 million exit and putting half of it with one GP across two deals, or maybe one deal, like that's just very difficult for me to understand, you know. And I think the counter to that, by the way, is like, what's the difference between that and then putting the $10 million into the stock market, into one stock? Like, why should one thing be regulated and another one not? And I think there is a healthy debate between the two.
I personally think there will be as well. I think there's going to be enough people losing money that's going to cause lawsuits. It's going to cause the administration to or the SEC to start looking. And you can already see that that's happening right now. Fraudulent activities are already occurring. Yeah. People panic and they do stupid things. Yeah. And, you know, in those times of stupidity can cause, you know, jail sentences, and we don't want that for anyone. But, you know, people, it happens. And so, but to your bigger point, I think there is a need for more, whether it's a test. I've heard testings of coming out, you know, to test if you're accredited, your sophistication around certain investment classes. I'm sure you get a lot of questions from your LPs about, yep, well, how could this be? You know, how could I be that I've lost all my money? I thought that the worst case scenario was that I get my money back, right? That's,
yeah.
And that's the wrong idea or hat going into, yeah, it,
yep,
where you needed to be more, no, that's not right. You're putting your big boy and big girl pants on. You can lose all your money. It's investing. That's yeah, inherent risk.
And I think, Reed, it's a phenomenal conversation, because also I think as part of that, it's like how much responsibility is on the LP for not knowing that. Like I think that's a very valid debate, because, you know, on the one hand, you know, maybe the GP shouldn't have taken an LP that's so clueless and they thought the worst case scenario is just to get your money back. But on the other hand, like, do your own DD, right? And this is an investment, and in any investment, like any person should know that you can lose your money. And oh, by the way, you signed a doc that says like 50 different times that you can lose all of it. But people, mm-hmm, sort of like, you know, just skim through that. And it's like, yeah, but that's not like, obviously I could lose all of it, but like, that's not going to happen until it does. Right. And I think a lot of it's sort of like that ethics, the ethics part of this gets very complicated very quickly.
Yes.
You know, like what type of investors you go after, non-accredited, even within the accredited space, as I said, most of my clients are accredited. And I would say also the majority of them don't know like how investing works, you know, and many of them do to some degree. Some of them have like really intense investing pedigrees too in other spaces, but they're very new to making sure that like that they... the syndication that they get into has the right like level of incentives between the GP and LP, and like what's market for fees and what should be a waterfall, what should be the co-invest, how do I analyze this deal, and is it risky? You know, it's complicated. And I always tell people, if really good passive investments start very active in the beginning, and if you're not prepared for that, like go buy an index fund. Like I feel pretty comfortable saying that.
No, I think also the other side of the coin here in this specific instance is the run-up in treasuries and the type of financing, which I think a lot more people are now starting to be aware of in these capital call events. Is like, why are we here? Now, the fundamentals of multi or whatever the asset class you might be in, how are they gone? And let's just take multi, for example. You know, there's a big supply, but the function of the financing is also causing a big problem, right, with floating rate debt. And when interest rates are very, very low and nearly free, people are going to jump in the pool and thus cause a lot of competition. Yep. And thus you do things in stretch and over leverage. And yes, when you break it down to the fundamentals, it's maybe not necessarily it's a bad deal. It's a bad financing structure. And yes, that's, you know, you didn't want to raise as much equity. You didn't want to get a rate cap. You didn't want to do X, Y, Z. You want to get pref on it because you have to raise less interest. You wanted, yep, to stretch and, you know, pay an extra $1 million because you wanted to get a deal. All these things I've seen happen in real time. But it's across the entire capital stack. Lenders have lent on that, right? Pref has lent on that. Investors have invested in that. Like there's no one person's fault to say that, you know, you should have seen that coming. But I think lessons as a GP and the ultimate decision maker, you know, I know that we have, and I'll talk openly about it, is like we've got one deal that's got floating rate debt. I'll never touch floating rate debt again, right? And it's not floating rate debt, it's bridge debt. Let's define the difference between the two. And if we had fixed rate debt on that thing, and that was bought 3 years ago. If we've done six deals since then, they're all fixed rate debt. No bloody problem, right? Yeah. So there's a debt element to it, and then there's also the valuation element, which I'd love to get your opinion on. Where I've seen because I underwrite a ton of deals every week. You've probably seen this as well. Is that as the Fed rate increases its rates, the value of assets decrease, right? Now, hard assets are not a stock ticker. You don't just go and be like, what's it worth today? Okay, what's it worth 20 minutes from now? What's it worth, tomorrow? Sure. it's going to be more slow on it. But most of the deals that are bought in the last 3 years are probably not worth what they bought them for, right? Because interest rates were low.
Yeah.
Now, that's not necessarily new, right? Interest rates and Fed rates will go up and down, and asset prices will go up and down across all asset classes. And sure. That's part of the cycles, and that's part of why you invest. And I think the other element, I'm saying a lot, I'm going on a bit of a rant here, is that we treated some of this multifamily or some of these investments as flips, as short-term, hey, I want to double my money in 2 years. I saw my friend do it. Why can't I do it? Historically, real estate has been medium to long-term. I come from a country in Australia where if you double your money in 10 years, you're doing just fine, right? And when you pause distributions or you have a bit of a rough patch, back to the sophistication of it, understanding that, well, I'm not just in this for 2 or 3 years, I'm in this for 7, and we're going to have a couple of years of bumpiness, but we're going to get through this and we're going to see the other side. Keeping that in mind when there's panic is very, very important. So said a lot there. I'll let you respond.
Yeah, no, I think everything that you said is right on. Cap rates have gone up. As cap rates go up, assuming NOI doesn't change, which is in and of itself an assumption that we can talk about for a while, given where, like, you know, the economy is, and many markets aren't keeping rents where they are today or where they were a year ago. But anyway, like, if you keep NOI stable, like, yeah, but I mean, by definition, like, the property starts being valued at a lower price point. And in some cases, as I said, I mean, I've seen something as extreme as someone bought a property, I think it was 4 years ago, which is actually like a pretty good basis, you would think, right? If you're generous in your assumptions, I think the property was worth about 30% of what the loan outstanding balance is. So today. Forget the equity part. Like, I'm just talking about the senior loan. And the other thing I would say is, in terms of like all the parties partying, so to speak, at the table at the time, definitely true. And in fact, like, I've heard some GPs, I have like some mixed feelings about this, but some GPs put in their like capital call documentation that, like, you know, look, it's not really our fault. Like, the lender lent to it, so clearly it was a good deal at the time. And it's like, I don't know if that's a proper approach. In other words, just because someone else did the deal doesn't mean you did a good deal. But at the same time, you're totally right. Like, I'm saying everyone was, you know, bidding across each other to like go 90% LTV. There's no question that that's true historically, right? And it's, I think where we're at today is kind of people are waking up to a new reality. I really try tell LPs to be level-headed. I write every single week, and I've written multiple articles on distress and like how to like speak to a GP where you have distress, how to notice distress if you don't have enough like reporting or whatever, sort of like how to figure it out on your own. And one of the things that I always tell people is when I get calls from an LP and they're like, man, like, I need to tell you about this GP, and they're like so bad, and I'm like, okay, like, go on. And they're like, well, you know, they promised a 2x, and like it took 3 months more than it was supposed to, and I only got a 1.5. And I'm like, really? Like, this is what you wanted to call me about? And the reason why I mention that is a lot of this is very like emotional, and some of it is not grounded in reality. Like, that same person, once I told them that the majority of the people that call me didn't get a 1.5x, they got a 0x. They're like, oh, like, so maybe 1.5 in this market is pretty good. Like, should I guess I should be happy about that then, yeah? And I'm like, yeah, I think you should. I think you really should. And again, like, it really depends on the context, of course, of what happened in that deal, and what, you know, what were the challenges and what the GP did. But my point is, stuff happens, and it's not always good. Right. And the reality on the ground is like the GP should be acting right in the best interest of the LP. And if you really feel like they did a good job at that and presented the right options at the right times and were really good stewards of your capital despite all the challenges, listen, if you get your money back, I think that should be a 5-star review. Being good stewards of capital and being transparent in some ways, I think, is underappreciated. You know, and I obviously I see the opposite a lot too. but it's a tough marketplace.
Yeah, no, it is. It is. And as an active sponsor myself, you know, I think the big thing is transparency. And when you do have problems, don't hide from them. You know, yep. One of the biggest things, go back to your emotion statement. One of the biggest things I think anyone who has that expectation is driven by emotion. And sometimes yeah. in bad situations, sponsors, the easiest thing they can do is just get on a phone call and let them hear the venting, right? Like, I've been on many calls where I've had to deliver some bad news, and it's like, it's not great. I don't want to be here, but I'm here to also hear what your gripes are, you know, like, and as soon as you take that human element back to it, it's like, no, I think you're doing the right job. I think you're doing the right thing. You know, I'm just pissed. You know, and you're like, and once you hear it, you're like, okay, well, appreciate your sentiments, and you know, we're gonna do better. And you've got, you know, this is how we're gonna do better. And having those real conversations helps breaks down that emotionalness around investing, right? And blame and all that sort of stuff. Because to your point, it's a risky thing, and you can lose all your money, and you got to go in eyes wide open. That's just a statement around managing it better in terms of hearing an investor's gripes in a situation where it's, you know, not great news. Don't ever hide away from it. Own up to it. Talk about it, and talk about it often and early.
I always say this, and it's really not meant to be in not even 1% threatening way. Sometimes LPs realize, probably 50% of the time, an LP reaches out to me on a capital call, and they realize from me that their equity position is worthless today. And I'm not talking about I never give like direct valuations, because obviously it depends on like how you value the NOI and the upside and like where our cap rates. So like it's always a range, but like at some point the range pretty clearly points to like the equity is gone, right? And so if you can say that with decent confidence, just like that's really unfortunate. In other words, like you should, your LPs should not be realizing that their investment is gone, in a sense, at least on paper, today, from like a third party.
100%, 100%. If that's the case, just tell it how it is.
Yeah, I guess you'd be surprised how often that doesn't happen. You know, even on capital call decisions, like just pretty wild communication. They sort of avoid the fact that all the money is gone and like put together these lofty pro formas that are like, there's sort of like degrees of possibilities, right? And I'm all for being optimistic, but then there's also sort of like a few degrees above optimistic, right?
The other thing you got to also ask yourself is when you've lost capital, and this isn't for the LPs out there listening, and I'd love your opinion on this, is, do you give the keys up today, or do you try and fight for, allow for something to happen in the future? Now, you and I both sitting here today, if you could kick the can 5 years down the line, I know a couple of things are going to be true. Yeah. Rents are going to go up, right? Rents are going to be more expensive than what they are today. I just know that because you look back at history. There's going to be blips, but they never go back down. They don't go from $1,000 down to $200. I think in general, the more time you have in the saddle, you get to get away from the start line, and you get to have a better chance at recouping some money, right? I'm not saying you're going to recoup all of it, but the more time in the saddle you have, it could be 5 years, it could be 10 years, it could be 3 years. 3 years is probably too soon, but you know, you're getting the 5 or 6 or 7 years out in a scenario where you've got a lender who wants to play ball, you've got a GP who's committed to making sure you're seeing the deal out. In my eyes, you would, as an LP, you would be like, they're fighting for it and I want it, you know, let's keep going. Now, some people may be avoiding reality, which is, you're talking about the institutions who got funds, but sometimes that may be the best scenario right this second. You may not have, you may not have a better scenario, but it's, well, I can buy you for 3 years, and at 3 years, we're going to have NOI, hopefully it's somewhere decent to go refi. And we'll make, you know, it's not, you're not getting zero, you're not getting 0 cents on the dollar. You might get 40 cents on the dollar. It's still a shitty outcome. Don't get me wrong, but it's not zero.
But it's better than giving the keys back today. Yeah. And
it's right.
And I think the big question in those circumstances is at what cost? In other words, if the decision tree is put nothing in and we can sort of see what happens in the future, then I think from the LP side, that's like, I mean, it's not even a decision. Obviously, you want to like roll the dice and And, you know, rather than give take nothing, you might have a chance of getting something. I think any LP will take that. It's not of any gamble. It's like a certainty, right? Anything greater than zero is better than zero. But the problem is usually in those circumstances, like that requires a cash and refi, or it requires a capital call because there's not enough money, or because like you need to put up a new dollar amount for the rate cap that you need to purchase, right? So like there's typically that component that makes a decision more complicated, which is, you know, at what point do you need to put up more money, and how realistic is the expectation that I'm going to get some money back from my original investment, A, but B, like what type of return am I expecting on the marginal cash that I'm about to put in? You know, I've seen both. Like I've seen capital call documentation that was like very thoughtful, right? And it sort of like walked the LP through the GP's thinking, and it becomes very evident that like they thought about the different options, and it's clear that they're not doing a capital call to save their own ass in terms of like not being on the front of the Wall Street Journal, but like they're doing the capital call because it's very clear that the additional X percent of the original investment will very realistically end with like, let's say 50% of capital back, which again is better than zero. And the other alternative is zero, right? But however, I've also seen the opposite, which is like, I mean, you just have like absolutely insane assumptions. And by the way, in those circumstances, like usually they get fully subscribed on the capital call. People like still invest out of fear. That's, you know, it's tough because, yep. You know, you just, a lot of time, like as we talked about before, like you're dealing with people that didn't have all the information and sort of didn't totally understand what they were getting into in the beginning. Now it's like this rush of, I don't really know what the plans are going to be, but like you have until Friday, otherwise we're going to have to give back the keys. Oh my gosh, like press here. And a bunch of people do it. And the vast majority of them do it, not even realizing that their last investment in probability is gone.
Look, I could talk to you for hours, my friend. It's actually a very timely call and interview to be having this. But what piece of advice do you have for those people listening today? We're recording in the Q1 of 2024 for moving forward into new investments, moving, you know, as they come about, you know, and not being jaded by one bad deal.
Yeah, I think the best piece of advice I always give to people is just try to understand what you're getting into, right? Like, it's okay to not understand perhaps like the perfect probability, so to speak, of some bad event happening, right? And there's certain, you can't always predict all risks. But, you know, just to give you an example, like if you have a deck in front of you and the deck predicts 200 basis point like cap rate compression, I always say like there's nothing wrong with that, right? As long as you understand that that's the assumption, right? And from an LP perspective, you need to realize that that's a market move as opposed to a GP move. Like a GP doesn't have control over that variable. It's macro dependent. And if you realize that is the case, hopefully you ask for like a sensitivity table or maybe even 30 in there that explains to you like, well, if that doesn't occur, like you'll still get your money back or you'll still get X, Y, and Z, right? So it's really important to have this like investor mindset, like no deal is perfect. They all have challenges. Like all of this is based on assumptions. And if someone lost their money, I think being out of the market doesn't help anyone either, right? At the same time, someone may say, look, like that was really tough. Like, I don't know if I'm mentally and intellectually prepared to analyze these investments. And I think that's a pretty valid conclusion too. Like, I think that should be somewhat celebrated in the sense if someone realized like, man, I had no idea what the hell I was doing. I just lost a bunch of money. At that point, they sort of have, I think, somewhat of a binary decision to make. Either they say, well, I'm out. Like I need to like sit out for the next 2 years to like be ready for this again. And I think that's valid. That's emotional. You know, I can't imagine how that feels. On the other hand, they might say, well, okay, I didn't know what I was doing, but now I want to learn, right? And that's also valid, right? But at least they're going into something understanding that they need to learn. And aren't going into things blindly anymore.
I think that's great advice, my friend. At the end of every show, we like to dive into the top five investing tips. These are lightning round, five questions we like to ask all our guests. You ready to get into it?
Yeah, let's try it.
Question number one, what's the daily habit you practice to keep on track towards your goals?
I like sort of like daily tasks. I try not to overcomplicate things as well. I think I used to like be overly organized, and I think it actually doesn't help.
Question number two is, who's the most influential person in your career to date?
I think it would be the former founder of Store. His name is Chris Volk, one of the smartest people I've ever met. And I still think that today. I speak to him a lot and I find him very helpful.
Question number three is, what is the most influential tool in your business? When I say a tool, it could be a physical tool like a journal, or it could be a piece of software that you just can't run the business without. What is it?
Big fan of Airtable. I used to be like very obsessed with Excel, but I've really enjoyed being on Airtable.
I've never heard of Airtable. What is that?
It's sort of like Excel on steroids, based in the cloud. Relational database, if that means anything to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. Okay. I'll have to check it out. Airtable. I'm a huge Excel nerd. I'll go check it out. Question number four is, in one sentence, what has been the biggest failure in your career? What did you learn from that failure?
Early on in my career, I thought I could sort of like do it all, you know, like I had the mentality of like, I could figure almost anything out. Most people can to some degree, but what the big thing that it misses is the fact that you just don't have strengths in all areas. So some things may take you 10 years to figure out, and you're still not going to be among the top, you know, percentile of performers. And so I've learned from that and from really many different experiences that I really try to ride my strengths, so to speak, as opposed to fight against my weaknesses.
Mate, last question is, where can people reach you to continue the conversation that will be in your sphere? Where do they go?
You can Google me. My name is pretty unique. I write weekly to, you know, 3,500 LPs at lplessons.substack.com. And then in terms of social media, if they want sort of daily updates, I'm pretty active on Twitter and LinkedIn, which is just under my name.
And just remind everyone, it's lplessons.substack.com, correct?
That's right. lplessons.substack.com.
It's a plural on the lessons for everyone listening out there. Well, Alexi, I want to thank you so much for jumping on today's show. I just want to reflect some of the things that I took away from today's show. I think it's your ability to find the niche in the world about and identifying that gap of being a good source of unbiased third-party review for limited partners is quite key. And in today's environment where there's a lot of distress out there, I'm sure your business is flourishing right now. So getting, but also seeing some of the lessons learnt from how people are dealing with capital calls or how investors are approaching investing in just in general. And I think that is being quite profound in that you've spoken to a lot of LPs out there that maybe not necessarily understood the totality of what they were getting into, that it is still a risky investment and that you can lose it all. Investing involves the risk of loss, as they say, and just sort of trying to communicate that to your clients is sounds like one of the biggest things. But did I leave anything out in that little summary?
I think that was great. It was a pleasure speaking, and I appreciate you having me on.
Awesome, my friend. Well, look, I want to thank you so much for jumping on the show. Enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll catch up very, very soon.
Yeah, thanks, you too.
Well, there you have it, another cracking episode jam-packed with an incredible lessons from Alexi. Remember, head over to, want to make sure everyone gets this email because you want to go over and check it out. It's lplessons.substack.com, where you can find everything that Alexi puts out there in terms of educating LPs on deals. You can use his services if you're looking at a deal right now. You know, I will say that Alexi and I, he does not sponsor the show, but he is genuine, comes with good form, and it's always good to get a second set of eyes on an investment and not just rely on the investment memorandum to say that this is the best deal since sliced bread. It's always good to get a second opinion. So highly, highly recommend you guys check him out. I want to thank you all again for taking some time out of your day to tune in to continue to grow your financial IQ. It's what we're all about here on this show. The easiest way to give back to this show is to give it a 5-star review on iTunes. And we're going to do this all again next week. So remember, be bold, be brave, and go give life a crack.